Welcome to Black Books Live. I'm your host, Cher J, along with my co-host, Jason Harris. And today we celebrate the writing of Toni Cade Bambata. Stay with us, and we'll be right back. Thank you all for tuning in to Black Books Live. It has been an exciting week hearing from our listeners. We've received ideas for books, authors to feature, and a whole lot of love from our listeners in the community, online, and beyond. Black Books Live is dedicated to highlighting our best for the world to hear. That means you, our listeners, giving us feedback about our webcast. So please visit our website at www.blackbookslive.com and click on the contact page and send us a note. Now I'm going to pass the mic to my co-host, Jason Harris, as he introduces today's featured author. Mr. Harris?
Thank you, Ms. Cher J, and greetings to our Black Books Live listeners. Thank you for once again tuning in. When one thinks of books and thinks of Toni, we all know who comes to mind. Our Nobel laureate, Pulitzer Prize-winning Grand Dame, Toni Morrison. Yet in the world of literature, there are two Tonys, and today we are focusing on the equally important Toni Cade Bambata. As with last week's episode, our featured writer was brought up in the fertile creative environment of Harlem, New York. Toni Bambata, born Miltonia Merkin Cade in 1939, recalled that when visiting the library as a child, she was often engaged in conversation by one Langston Hughes. Bambata states, "Langston Hughes lived diagonally across the street, and he would break three rules that endeared him to me forever. First of all, he would come into the library and would not take off his hat, not because he was rude, but because he was loaded down with a briefcase, portfolio, a satchel of books. He was coming to work. He had great hats. He had a Borsellino that I would really like to have. The second violation was he would come into the children's section. As you know, in those days, age borders were very strict and they were very heavily patrolled. If you were little, then you went over here and you listened to Sunday school stories. If you were a grown-up, you were over there listening to the senior choir. If you were in the movies, you were in the children's section, roped off with that lady in the white dress with the flashlight to hit you with and to keep you all in check. The rest of the movie house was for the grown-ups. It was the same thing with the library. So Mr. Langdon, as we thought he was called, would come into the children's library, would stroll along the windowsill, looking at the sweet potato plants stuck with toothpicks hanging in the wide-mouthed amber jars, and he would comment on them. We would always be looking at him thinking, is he the stranger our parents always warned us against? Was he the pervert we had to watch out for? What was he doing in the children's library? Then he would come and sit down with us and spread out his work. He was always very careful about space. If his book hit yours, he would say, excuse me. I can't tell you how rare that was in those days. Nobody had respect for children or their sense of space. Well, he would be writing, reading, and pondering, and then he would look up and break the third rule. He would talk. He would ask us what we're doing. What kind of homework we have? Do we think it is intelligent homework? What was on our minds? The man was a knockout." That was taken from an interview conducted by Louis Messiah and included in Deep Sightings and Rescue Missions. The title of the interview is How She Came by Her Name. Bambata's approach to writing was shaped in this culturally rich community and later augmented with an extensive academic and professional pedigree. The result is a singular style of prose characterized by poetic streams of consciousness, nonlinear plots, incredibly diverse dialogue that is unerringly tuned into the nuances of race, gender, age, and culture, as well as a commitment to connecting contemporary events to the fate of her characters. Bambaataa's first book, The Black Woman, published in 1971, was a groundbreaking anthology which featured women writers. Her collections of short fiction, Gorilla My Love, and The Seabirds Are Still Alive, established her voice in the American literary landscape. Her 1980 masterpiece, the novel The Salt Eaters, won the American Book Award. Bambaataa then turned her attention to filmmaking, collaborating with Louis Messiah of the Scribe Video Center in Philadelphia to create the award-winning documentary, The Bombing of Osage Avenue. In 1995, Toni Cade Bambaataa joined The Ancestors, but she left behind two more books, one a collection of fiction and essays entitled Deep Sightings and Rescue Missions, and a haunting novel about the Atlanta child murders, Those Bones Are Not My Child, which was edited by Toni Morrison herself. Black Books Live is presenting three excerpts from Toni Cade Bambaataa's work today. The first is a short story that was featured in Deep Sightings and Rescue Missions. So without further ado, Black Books Live proudly presents Cher J reading Toni Cade Bambaataa's The Wall.
You are listening to Black Books Live. Me and Lou had no time for courtesies. We were late for school, so just flat out told the painter lady to quit messing with the wall. It was our wall, and she wasn't even from the neighborhood. Stirring in the bucket, she mumbled something about she had permission to paint on it from the owner of the barbershop. That had nothing to do with it as far as we were concerned. It was our wall. We'd been pitching pennies against the barbershop wall since we were very little kids. We played handball and pop fly against that wall since so-called integration, when the crazies crossed town, shut the park down, and poured cement in the swimming pool so we couldn't use it. I sprained my neck boosting Cousin Lou up on that wall so that he could chisel Jimmy Lyon's name on it when we found out he wasn't ever coming home from Vietnam to teach us how to fish. If you lean close, Lou said to the painter lady, you get a whiff of bubble gum and kid sweat, and that'll fix you. This wall belongs to us kids of Talbro Street. Lou was standing hip shot next to her beat up old piece of car with out of town plates, jabbing the air as he spoke and sounding very convincing. But she paid us no mind at all. She snapped the brim of her straw hat down and hauled her bucket up the ladder. If anybody has a right to do anything to this wall, Lou shouted up to her, it's Miss Morris. Miss Morris ought to take the wall to court as evidence, I was thinking. Last month in the night, some cops got rough with the Morris boy because he was out late and didn't answer their questions fast enough to suit them. They rammed his shoulder against the wall and might have done worse if Mr. Eubanks hadn't happened along. He told the cops that the Morris boy was a fine person, just a little slow, so they let him go. You're destroying evidence, I said to the painter lady when she started making big sweeps with her brush. You're going to go to jail. She went right on about her business, which made me mad. Lou had to drag me away, and I was shaking her ladder so bad. You don't even live around here, I hollered over my shoulder. I thought of a lot more to say, but we were passing my folks' restaurant, and that's all my mama would need to hear me sassing a grown-up. When we came from school, the wall was slick with white. The painter lady was running string across the wall and taping it fast here and there. Me and Lou leaned against the gumball machine outside the pool hall and watched. Then she started chalking the strings with a chunk of blue chalk. Across the way, Mrs. Morris and her boy were leaning out the kitchen window watching. When the painter lady snapped the strings, the blue chalk dust measured off halves and quarters up and down and sideways, too. Lou muttered something about how hip that was. But I dropped my book satchel on his toes to remind him We were at war. Then the Morris twins crossed over the projects and hung back at the curb to watch. The twin with the red ribbons was hanging a jug of cloudy lemonade. The one in the yellow ribbons was holding a plate of dinner away from her dress. Some good aromas was drifting out from under that tin of tinfoil, and pale green juice from the greens was leaking on the twin socks. The painter lady paid no more attention to them and the gift of supper than she did to me and Lou or the fire hydrant. When she wanted to deepen the line, she just reached around behind her for the blue chalk. When she wanted the scissors to cut the string or lay the blade flat to pry the tape loose, she just fumbled behind her amongst the stuff she had laid out on the sawhorse table. I figured the woman for a rude, no-nose fool. Next to my mother, Miss Morris cooks up the tastiest smelling food in the neighborhood. Side Pocket came strolling out of the pool hall to see what me and Lou were studying so hard. He gave the painter lady the once over, checking out her paint splattered jeans, her chalky t-shirt, her floppy brim hat. He hitched up his pants, even though he had on a belt and suspenders, and kind of glided over toward the table. "What you got there, sweetheart?" he asked the twin with the plate.
"Supper,"
she said, all soft like and country, which is the Morris way.
"For her,"
the one in yellow said, jutting her chin toward the painter's lady's back. Still, she didn't turn around. She was rearing back on her heels, her hands jammed into her back jean pockets, her face squinched up like the masterpiece was taking shape on the wall by magic. We could have been gophers crawled up in a rotten hollow for all she cared. Lou was saying something about how great her concentration was. I gave him a butt with my hip, and his elbow slid off the gumball machine, and he stumbled. "Good evening," Side Pocket said in his best ain't I fine voice. But the painter lady was acting like a mental case. She was up on the milk crate, over to the step stool, up and down the ladder, hanging off it to reach a far spot. She was scribbling all over the wall like a definite crazy person and not even looking where she was stepping. It was like those old movies where the dancer taps all over the furniture, kicking chairs over but not skipping a beat, leaping over radios and all. Lou looked like he wanted to applaud, but I had my foot on his feet and an elbow in his ribs. It was quite a show, but it wasn't right. The twins standing there being ignored. Miss Morris and her boy were nearly hanging out the window trying to signal the twins to step up and be bold. Side Pocket said. Side Pocket cleared his throat. The painter lady paused, one foot on the milk crate, one foot on the top of the step stool. These ladies here. Side Pocket was running out of words, so I jumped in. "Your dinner's getting cold, lady. At least you could say good evening." Then she kind of turned. You could tell she didn't recognize anybody. I mean, we could have been penguins or bags of laundry. She was resting her eyes on for a second till she swung her head back to work. "Ma'am?" At last, the twin stepped forward, and not a moment too soon. Side Pocket was sputtering, not used to women ignoring him like that, and Miss Morris and her boys were practically out on the window ledge trying to coax the girls forward.
"Mama said to bring you some supper."
I was kind of off somewhere from hearing Freda Morris say supper like that, all soft like a wide cotton, so I didn't hear whether the painter lady said anything or not. But she did walk over, her eyes full of sky, as my grandmother would say, meaning in a daze, a trance, another place. She wiped her hands on her jeans, rolled back a bit of tinfoil, then wagged her head as though it was a horse's head instead of hams, greens, yams, and cornbread. "Thank your mother very much," she said, with her mouth full of sky too, sounded like. "I've brought dinner along, actually." And then, without even excusing herself for anything, she was back on the ladder drawing in a wild way. It was just too much for Side Pocket, so he went back in the pool room with the sides of his mouth pulled down. It was too much for me, too, so I dragged Lou away to go meet my daddy at work.
From the telephone company to the restaurant, me and Lou were waiting for a pause to get our 2 cents in. We wanted to tell my daddy about the painter lady and ask if he had any good ideas for running her back to wherever she came from. But Daddy was talking about the trip to the country, how Lou could come with us because the old folks always appreciated another pair of hands on the farm. We forgot about the war for a while and went on in the back of the restaurant to do our chores. Later that night, come to find out the painter lady was a liar. She came into the restaurant and leaned against the glass of a steam table, allowing us to see she was a very starved woman. Me and Lou peeked over the service ledge and listened. We never really heard her speak more than a sentence or two. She was really running off at the mouth. Was that a ham hock in those greens? Was that a neck bone in the pole beans? Did my mother have any vegetables cooked without meat, especially pork? I don't care who your spiritual leader is, Mama said in that way of hers. Eat in the community, sister. You eat pig by and by one way or the other. We were in the back cracking up. Lou was tearing up lettuce for the solids pot. I was scrubbing out the muffin tents. We were waiting for my mama to fix her wagon because my mama don't take no stuff off nobody in her place. Plus, she can't abide people who don't speak to elders when they walk into a place. And a painter lady hadn't said boo to a soul, young or old. So Mama waited on everybody else first. But the painter lady kept right on with the questions, even after she took a stool at the counter. Was there cheese in the baked macaroni, she wanted to know. Was there eggs in the potato salad? Was the iced tea already sweetened with sugar? Mama was fixing Pop Jacob's plate at the time, piling on another spoonful of rice each time another stupid question came up. Me and Lou wondered where in the world the painter lady was from that they make potato salad without hard-boiled eggs. Do you have any bread made with unbleached flour? Me and Lou crack up, me bending low over the suds, Lou chopping onions, laughing and crying at the same time. I could hear my mama doing that whistle sigh through the gap in her front teeth. But I could also hear Pop Jacobs cackling. He was happy with the whole deal. His plate was heap high. Mama finally ran out of customers to wait on first, so she started taking the painter lady's order. She couldn't make up her mind whether she wanted broiled fish and a salad or a vegetable plate. She finally settled on a pan trout once Mama assured her that, yeah, she knew how to cook a pan trout without a lot of oil. But just when Mama reached for a plate to put the salad on, the painter lady leaned over the counter. Excuse me, one more thing. She had a chalky blue finger in the air. Everybody in the restaurant was holding their breath to hear what the painter lady would say next and whether Mama would fling the plate. I boosted up on the sink. Mama was blowing a wisp of hair out of her eye, tapping one foot and holding that plate like a frisbee. Yeah, Mama said. What is it? Can I get cucumbers and beets in that tossed salad? Mama leaned her hot face right close to the painter lady's, and the customers kind of leaned forward too. You will get, Mama said, whatever Lou tossed. Now sit down and be quiet. And the painter lady sat down and shut right up. All the way to the country, we tried to get Mama to open fire on the painter lady, but Mama said she was probably from up north and didn't know any better. Then Mama said that she was sorry she got on her like that because she was a decent person, just very picky about her diet. As we all should be, Mama sighed, cutting her eye at the bag of potato chips I just finished. Me and Lou didn't want to hear that. Who did she think she was coming into our neighborhood messing with our wall? Well, Mama said, pulling the gas station so Daddy could take his turn at the wheel. She's some kind of artistic person. It ain't easy to get folks to look at your work if you're stuck away somewhere. So she's painting in public. I guess that's all right. Me and Lou definitely did not want to hear that. We wanted to hear something better than that, especially after we told Mama how she egged the twins and turned Miss Morris's hospitality down. Mama got quiet for a long while, her muscle in her jaw jumping. I expected to hear her call the painter lady a barbarian. That's one of Grandma's words for people who forget to honor the ways. But when me and Lou kept on about it, Mama said to hush because she was tired. She climbed into the back seat and dropped down into the warm hollow Daddy had made into the pillow. All weekend, we tried to scheme up ways to take our wall back. Daddy said we were getting sickening about it. Mama said to sit down and be quiet. My grandparents said to quit dropping cake drums between the sofa cushions. Me and Lou were miserable until a movie came on about New York. In one scene, a train pulled into the station covered from top to bottom, side to side, windows too, with drawings and writings done with spray paint. Granddaddy said the ones who did it should have to scrub it clean with toothbrushes. Grandma said it was a shame kids in New York didn't have something better to do, like chores. Mama said, And Daddy was asleep. So he didn't see me and Lou slap five. We couldn't wait to get back to the block. We couldn't find a can of black spray anywhere, but in a junky little hardware store downtown, we put our allowance together and brought a can of white epoxy, the kind you tuck chop old refrigerators with when you're trying to sell them. We'd spent our car fare, and it was too late to use our school bus passes. We had to walk home lugging our books, our gym shoes, our shorts, and the bag with the can of spray paint. When we got to the corner, it looked like a block party. The only things missing were the food stalls. The whole neighborhood had turned out, gathered on the sidewalk. Side Pocket and his buddies were standing, leaning on their cue sticks, hunching each other. Daddy was there with one of the linemen he catches the lift with sometimes. Miss Morris had her arms stretched wide, resting on the shoulders of her children on either side of her. Mama was talking with her cooking spoon, looking like a drum majorette leading the parade. Customers were standing with her, napkins silly at the throat. Mr. Eubanks came out, followed by a man in a striped poncho, his face half shaved, the other half full of foam. She really did it, didn't she? Mr. Eubanks huffed out his chest like he'd just performed major surgery and the patient lived. Didn't she, though? He started pressing people around him. Lots of people answered quick when they saw the razor in his hand. But you could tell he didn't know he had it, which made it all the funnier to me. Mama called us over, and then we saw it, the wall.
You are listening to Black Books Live. The Salt Eaters is a novel about many things. The novel's events are centered around a healing session for a local community organizer who has attempted suicide. The town faith healer, Minnie Ransom, and a circle of supporters work feverishly to heal Velma Henry, the community organizer. Along the way, we meet an all-woman group of cultural revolutionaries, a daydreaming bus driver, a spirit guide, nuclear engineers, a pimp-turned-hospital administrator, a pregnant teen and her bumbling boyfriend, a physician with an identity crisis, and many more. The Salt Eaters is a multi-layered book that gives you insight every time you pick it up. So here is Cher J reading an excerpt from Tony Cade Bambara's The Salt Eaters.
Nadine saw it happen, saw something drop away from Miss Henry's face. Nadine had not wanted to move closer, but was glad Buster had moved her off the spot. Because if she'd gone on standing there, she would have run screaming into the halls. And if she'd gone on standing there, she would have found some way to get on top of a table and clog away in them shoes Miss Haywood had gotten on her about. And if she'd gone on standing there, she would have had to make some kind of move, some kind of noise. Still, she wanted to make some noise, wanted something loud going on, something louder than just the scratchy sound of Buster's mustache against her face. Louder than the new whispery way he'd been talking to her lately in her ear. Louder than the swish of his corduroy pants as he left her. She could never go down into the cellar without making noise, without grabbing the old muffin tin off the hook and scraping it along the wall. Scraping her knuckles sometimes, but she didn't care, because the main thing was not to hear the mice or rats or squirrels or whoever they were scurrying around down there
when she went for the maternity clothes in her aunt's trunk. Or home alone or babysitting by herself, she'd have the radio, the stereo, and the TV going all full blast and calling anybody, Cynthia even, to talk and laugh with, to get the spooky dark to stop in the hall, and the no fair creeping past the line of the door. She prayed when she turned for a second to bite the side of her thumbs. She didn't know what she saw fall or what she saw once or whatever it was that fell away from Miss Henry. But the whole thing was scary. At least at first it was. And she kept trying to put the brakes on, but Buster kept on inching them closer. And then it wasn't scary at all. Felt okay. She felt a straightening. What she caught a bit of at the falling away did something to her spine, made her stretch up like they were always telling her to do at the clinic. Only not a real reaching like into high cupboards or the top shelf of a linen closet. Just to think up and stretch the spine. So she made up a game in the past 3 weeks of hanging pecan pies up in the air, of hanging up cans of root beer and sometimes bundles of dollar bills that she could have only if the top of her hair knocked them down from the make-believe strings and she could catch them. And when Nadine got over being scared and finished with stretching her spine, she felt still another thing about seeing Miss Henry's face lift off and a prettier woman appear. She felt special, felt smart, like she'd never felt at home or at school. Something important was happening, and she was part of it. Something bigger than the 2+2 way everybody else lived from day to day was going on, and she was right there, and part of it. Whatever it was that had fallen away was showing her another way to be in the world. There's nothing that stands between you and perfect health, sweetheart. Can you hold on to that thought? Nothing can hold me from my good, Velma drawled, reciting a remembered Sunday school lesson. Neither famine nor evil nor... And then a fourth thing. Nadine felt a kinship with a woman she did not even know, had never met, had only heard about from Buster, who lived on her block, or Miss Haywood, who considered both her and the woman goddaughters. She'd seen the covers fall, knew the feeling, the nakedness of it. Graduating from the shelter of closed-in desks, wide enough to hide behind with fingernail polish and love notes and a stick of gum, thrumbled up, small and tight for popping right into the mouth behind the desk lid. Then suddenly, the wide-open one-arm chairs of high school and everything out and drooping socks, the ashy legs, the banged-up knees, the two short hand-me-down clothes stretched over her swelling belly. But Miss Henry didn't grab herself up small and tight on the stool or try to duck her head down or hide or anything. She wasn't even trying to fix herself up in front of all the people. Didn't even check to see if the hospital gown was open, which it was. And if her butt was out, which it wasn't because she had on panties, but still. So Nadine didn't feel like clenching her thighs tight anymore or putting the brakes on with her shoes anymore. She moved closer all on her own, Buster not even there. But it was all right now, and this was the real thing. And she was about to know, or maybe already knew, something her smart-ass friend Cynthia, for all her knowing, would probably never know. Nadine knew she was not the stupid girl teachers thought she was, or the silly child the nurses thought she was. Babies having babies, her neighbors had sighed. She could argue now with the folks at the clinic. How come she was old enough to sign the papers giving consent for the baby to be taken care of when it came, but wasn't old enough to sign for herself? Had to have her aunt and the social worker give her consent? It was always the same. Too old to do this, too young to do that. No more. Nadine moved closer and would have moved right up to the two stools to join hands with the healer and the woman if the prayer group weren't already there round the two like a gate. She was a woman, or at least she wrinkled her nose to herself at too big a jump. She was womanish. You are listening to Black Books Live.
Welcome back to Black Books Live. And now we return to our presentation of Tony Cade Bambata's The Salt Eaters.
She might have died, might have been struck by lightning where she sat, but then she might have died an infant gasping, but for my dear Sophie's holding hands. Might have drowned in her baptism gown, or legs wrapped round some strange man's head, too strange for repetition ever, holding on to his ears lest he make a sudden move, balancing more weight on the pin of her spine and thinking her heart would give out any minute, and not because the fucking and sucking and all that petite mort good, but because this weirdo she picked up in the library of all places kept lifting his head every other stroke, his breath reeking up at her over her trembling belly, to tell her what he was going to do to her. Crazy things he was going to do with a broom handle and a vacuum hose as soon as he finished doing what he was doing to her. And how to pull away and get away and not be hurt? Who could tell what mad thing he was capable of? And of all the things, to be taking up precious space in her head, where strategies needed to be laid out and studied. But some odd piece of lesson overheard in Medea's class about the master brain being in the uterus, where all ideas sprung from and were nurtured and released to the lesser brain in the head. And damned if it didn't seem to be the case. She might have fried in that SRO hotel that terrible summer on the road when some two-time bitter wife sloshed gasoline under the door. Not her door, but the door of a woman met on the march who wouldn't hear of Velma and the kids sitting up all night in the bus station or taking a chance in the churchyard with blankets, but gave Velma a key to her room and gave her too the nightmare wife cursing through the door and flinging a book of matches in the puddle. And no phone in the room, and the fire escape rickety, and the kids, no matter how they were yanked and shoved and screamed, moving like they were underwater. And she was descending a rusty ladder that turned little James and Palmer's girls red, wondering what sort of lesson this would turn out to be when her lungs cleared and her head cleared, and the anger, smoke, rage, and soot gave her space to think and feel it through. Might have bled to death in the Coke machine era because emergency was full up and the head nurse was making it crystal clear that coloreds weren't serviced there. Trailing blood through the ambulance yard, her bundle slipped pressed against her head that had been slammed hard against the concrete floor when a junkie going nuts had been tossed in the cell with the women demonstrators while someone in front counted out the money for the fine very slowly. But always there was a tug to come on, get up, move out, nudging her back toward life. Even standing by the open drawer in the kitchen, forgetting all she knew, even climbing into the oven, forgetting who she was tugged, was claimed. Move out. And the assistants lifted her on the litter and carried her out to the doors, to the straw mat in the courtyard, where the well-wishers could pass by and give advice, read signs, interpret, hand her medicaments fresh chopped from the bush to chew, fresh brought from the market to burn and inhale, fresh purchased from the apothecary to drink or swallow. And the ground rumbling, as if a stone were being rolled away and someone reading that too. Velma, some lives ago, on the mat, on her back with feathers and bird bones and a sheet of painted bark spread over her. Voices droning. Readings. A crab had attacked a fisherman and held on or dropped off in the sand meaning. A fig unripe had dropped from a tree and burst open. Mud oozing, smelling like stink fish meaning. A mushroom cap toppling like a severed head meaning. A wheel falling off its axis face down meaning. An old Baron Sam clinking by looking for an invitation to sup. But the walkabout, marabout, coming sooner and sending the dancers reading into their tasks, to dance, to leap about. They act the fish, then fly, and are the birds, tail in the air, and fingers hunch over the arms. They go monkey, dancing and loud, acting the medicine people who leap the healing circle and wait for what we run from troubled. They act the sun, head, arms, hearts, rich with recitation and the word. They send a child to fetch Velma from her swoon and fetch a strong rope to bind the wind, to circle the world while they swell the sea with song. She is the child they sent. She is the song. Be calm, Minnie Ransom crooned, her words going out over Velma's hunched shoulder and into the room like warm hands caressing. Stain thunder shaking the room. And it was Pony, Daniel's twin Poindexter, who took up the song, mouth wide open now and notes cutting through the gloom. Velma tried to hear it, couldn't hear it, but felt it pass against her skin, pushing her back into the cocoon of the shawl where she died again. The gas lines, six blocks of enraged drivers, lined up at the pumps in a well-wired time bomb, zombie eyes in the prison treatment center, turned into the streets running amok, or run down and trampled in the storming of the utility companies, or taking of the food sheds, or the Pentagon. Dying in uniform when everyone, not white, male and of wealth, is drafted to fight on foreign turf, but not for oil or diamonds or labor or markets, but for burial grounds. The bodies piled high near the borders of warring nations, bodies that cannot be cremated because of the smoke and wind and rain, and can't be buried because missiles would be heated up by the contamination and there's no room anymore underground, space taken up by equipment and uniforms. Bodies that can't be launched into space anymore because NASA has long since gotten a reply and beings out there are sick of howdy doody and spinning satellites and telstars and intrusive rocket probes and have made their terms clear. And can't be shipped for burial to Antarctica because cemeteries heating up have already melted the ice caps and tidal waves have inundated half the earth. Might have been killed for the prize of her gumboots, mask, and bubble suit in the raid. The unrecognizable children who run the streets, taking over abandoned social service agencies, and subways, and concert halls, and armories, finally taking over her too. Offspring of the children who roamed in vacant lots and city dumps years before, when old smoke detectors leached americium into the dirt, their clothes, their jeans. Kids who dug up for fun the contaminated uniforms and instruments, the abandoned uniforms of workers hunted by the angry mob, awakened too late and misdirected in their hatred. Those kids grown up twisted and wasted, given birth to the ones shunned, turned out, driven off, who fought each other and ran in packs and found her on the street, beat her down and snatched her protection, which would bring a high price on the open market. Lying there on her back, smaller than she'd been in years, lighter, feeling free, shoulders no longer bowed from the weight of the suit, nostrils stinging, breathing air strongly, chemical, detergent, chlorine, and something faintly remembered from the generator in chem lab when she was a student many long years ago, and the stockaded compound too far to drag herself to, even though she was feeling this light. A pain in the center as she jackknifes, waiting for the convulsions to begin. She cries out, but the children are moving off swiftly, the sucking sound of their spongy feet the only thing she hears. They leave gelatinous smears on the pavement and gluey smells where they stood, beating her down onto the ground that threatens to suck under her, where she lies and twists. Her last glimpse is of something familiar. Something from the old days when she was young. A slingshot in the pocket of one of the stompers. A forked stick jutting out like a willow switch that a water witch of old would use, divining water, scanning the ground, dipping and nodding, finding what no geologist can find as quickly. A slingshot with which to shoot the five smooth stones against the forehead and penetrate the middle eye and pierce the veil. She is smiling, on her back, staring at what used to be called sky. She'd asked a simple question enough of her teacher. Why is God called the Alpha and the Omega?
and that triggered the alphabet lesson, one symbol a week. Medea taught alphabet in a way that made Mama May leave the room and shut the door. She couldn't remember why the fork glyph whose vibe was holy to seekers. All Y meant to her was the wishbone she and Palma tussled over, which always broke to no one's satisfaction. But lying there on her back, she was upright in the wet street, a babble of past before her, but her choice made long ago. The fork in the road, the wishbone, the switch, the water witch wand, the slingshot, Y bird. It was all the same, somehow. She did not regret the attack of the children. She regretted only as she lay on the straw mat, lay on the ground, pressed between the sacred rocks, lying on her back under the initiation knife at an age when the female element is circumcised from the boys and the male excised from the girls, regretted only as she moved the knife aside and the shiver ran from spine to crown, and she bled in the elder pack cobwebs and mud that would not dam the gush, and she bled on as she dreamt she would. Regretted, lying between the rocks and staring up at the clouds surrounding the moon, clouds so like the cauliflowers Mama May filled her lunch pail with, clouds like wispy cotton snatched from dentist's dispensers. Regretted that she would not get promoted to the next class to learn about the nature of life on Earth, and the human and the spiritual purpose, because the planet was plunging into darkness and she was twisting around toward the last of the light, her tongue probing her mouth for signs of breath, slapping around out of control and ripping open on the serrated teeth till she was bleeding from everywhere. "I'm getting a message," Minnie yanking frantically at old wife's dress and grabbing air, her guide gone off to chapel at the critical moment. Minnie moving quickly, pressing her tongue down, hard away from her back molars. It was coming to her like a siren, not at all like instructions. A frequency, not used before, more shrill than the signal from Saturn's rings, less timbre than the telling from a ring of wisdom, more static than the CBs or traffic waves. A wiry, shrill siren that spun in her head like a gyroscope. She was holding her jaws and heading toward the path, moving swiftly through the woods, not cloistered now at the crest by the sheltering branches, but thrown open, clear, gliding over the lemongrass, damp against her legs, her shoes squishy like never before. She pauses merely to check the rainbow. It is not there, its colors absorbed by needy people, its vibes spiritualizing, soaked up, left faint and toneless. She pulls down quickly the branch to finger the moist leaf, to drink from it and chew the leaf, trying to give herself pause to think, be calm, breathe into her surroundings. Old wife running up. "Pentagon."
"Say which?"
"You mean like that thing you draw in the dirt with 5 points?
"Pentagon.
Where's it at?" Old wife turning and casting suspicious glances. "Lower left by cuspid." Loud and clear, red alert.
"That right. Why didn't you tell me? Is this it?"
"What you mean it?"
"Oh, hell, why am I wasting time with you?" Minnie says, turning, wondering if there was time to race back, to appeal to the Loa who can short-circuit, engulf, misdirect an electric charge, jumping from cloud to cloud, even if she stands there looking up at what should have been the rainbow.
Why hadn't she give the sacred jugs and pots a really good sweetening with some baking soda and prepared something extra special for the Loa's festival? It was nothing to them to jump to the cloud and swallow up the flash in a cloak for the asking.
"And what makes you think it ain't them haints messing about the electricity?"
"Not now, fool, not now. You ain't got the sense you were born with, Minnie Ransom. Everything's all right. I'm with you."
"Oh, my Lord."
Cora Ryder moaned before Anna Banks could say it. They clutched each other and grabbed at strangers, too, and there was nothing soothing now about the singing. It was like Phantom of the Opera and every other spooky movie she'd seen. She wished the Daniels would quit.
"That one was enough to shift the needle on the university seismograph," Doc said.
The he-he smothered in his throat, constricted with fear. The room was shaking, and the Claiborne was nobody's California. Nadine held a chair and steadied herself. The baby, rushing from the front of her, had slammed into her back,
turned and was now shifting around, trying to distribute its weight. She closed her eyes and patted 1-2, 1-2.
That was the kind of thunderbolt knocked Saul off his steed and turned him into Paul, Cora said, releasing her friend to move toward the young girl and brace her.
This was no time to be fainting or going into labor. Not when the good woman Ransom was so close to bringing her patient around. She walked the girl to a chair carefully. But for all her caring and concern, Cora was busy checking calendar and clock, trying to calculate a 3-digit number she could box for the morrow. Years hence, she would remember the beginning was not the payoff, not the beautician finally come across with the money she had won, but was the moment Pony Daniels of the circle raised his voice and sang about the time his dungeon shook and his chains fell off. Velma would remember it as the last moment she started back toward life, the moment when the healer's hand had touched some vital spot and she was still trying to resist, still trying to think of what good did WoW do you, since there was always some low-life, gruesome gang-bang raping, lawless, careless, pesty, last straw, nasty thing ready to pounce, put your total shit under the arrest and crack your back, but couldn't. And the years hence she would laugh, remembering she thought that was an ordeal.
She didn't know the half of it, of what awaited her in years to come. Thank you for joining us here at Black Books Live. Tune in next week for episode 3 as we travel into the deep south with Arthur Flowers and his scintillating tale of a romance between a piano man and a hoodoo woman. Another good loving blues. I am Cher J.
And I am Jason Harris.
And until next time, onward and upward. Star child, yet still unsung. Wild and peaceful, elegant lady, beautiful phoenix with wings to flow the air and soar the valley, paprika plains everywhere, voice of an angel.